This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Millions of people around the globe are familiar with the story of George Bailey, famously played by Jimmy Stewart in Frank Capra's iconic Christmas movie, It's a Wonderful Life. Ordinarily, this is when we would give you the plot summary, but even if you haven't seen it, you very likely know what it's about. Well, this Christmas season, you'll have a chance to see a different version. Playmakers Repertory Company in Chapel Hill is doing a stage adaptation of It's a Wonderful Life. It's running through the 16th of December, and it is staged as a live radio play with five actors supported by music and sound effects. The cast of It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play, joins us now in the studio. They are Ray Dooley, Brandon Garignani, Katya Hill, Todd Lawson, Maren Searle, and joining us are Mark Lewis, who is the music director, and Nelson Eusebio, who is the director of the program. Welcome. It's a Wonderful Life. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
So, Nelson, give us the background of this stage adaptation. When was this written?
This adaptation was written in 1996. For some reason, through some lapse in copyright law, It's a Wonderful Life entered the public domain. So there are Joe Landry, who's the playwright and adapter, essentially saw this, worked for, he has his own community theater in Connecticut, and was like, this would be really great for us to do as our holiday show, and then created the adaptation. So that was like 96. And then I think how it came to Playmakers is Jeff Mienza saw a production at the Long Wharf Theater, also in Connecticut, and really enjoyed it and brought it back to Joe and them, and was like, this should be our holiday
show. And it's not just a recreation of the film. It is actually staged as a radio play. So tell us what we see on the stage.
So when you enter the theater, you get a little bit of wonderful holiday music, courtesy of Mark Lewis at the piano as our sound and Foley man. And you enter a 1940s radio station. So it's set in 1946. It's in a radio station that feels very much like the Rockefeller Center in New York City at the time. And it's called WPRC, and it's a 1940s, it looks like vintage Rockefeller Center, Art Deco, the whole nine.
Well, I'm glad you made a reference to public radio in your call letters. That was very thoughtful of you. I wonder if we can get a sample right now. Can we have a scene?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's bring in the scene from the very beginning, and something that sort of sets forth the universe and the two different values that are at conflict between good and evil that are at work in this world. A scene between right after George Bailey meets the girl of his dreams.
George's father died that night, Clarence, and so, of course, he couldn't go to Europe. But that fall, just before he was going to leave for college, the directors of the building and loan held a meeting. They were going to appoint a successor.
Now, I want the board to know that George gave up his trip to Europe to help us straighten things out these past few months, and it was greatly appreciated. I think that's all we'll need you for, George. Good luck to you at school. I know you are anxious to catch a train.
Yes, I have a taxi waiting downstairs.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to get to my real point. Mr. Chairman, I maintain that this institution is not necessary to this town. Therefore, Mr. Chairman, I move that we dissolve the building and loan and turn its assets and liabilities over to the receiver.
It is too soon after Peter Bailey's death to discuss chloroforming the building and loan.
Yes.
It was his faith and devotion that are responsible for this organization.
I'll go further than that. I'll say that to the public, Peter Bailey was the building and loan. Peter Bailey was not a businessman. That's what killed him. No, I mean no disrespect to him. God rest his soul. But Peter Bailey was a man of high ideals, so-called. But high ideals without common sense can ruin this town. What does it get us? A discontented, angry rabble instead of a thrifty working class. And all because a few starry-eyed dreamers like Peter Bailey stir them up and fill their heads with a lot of impossible hooey. Now I say...
Just a minute. Now hold on there, Mr. Potter. You're right when you say my father was no businessman. Why, I know that. Why he ever started this cheap penny-ante building and loan, I'll never know. But neither you nor anybody else can say anything against his character, because his whole life was... Why, in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this place, he never once thought about himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy?
You got that right.
He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Why, here... Here, you're all businessmen here. Doesn't it make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said... What did you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even ought to think of a decent home? Wait. Wait for what? Until their children are all grown up and leave them until they're so broken down and old that... Do you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, this rabble you're talking about. They do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle. Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be.
I'm not interested in your book. I'm talking about the building and loan.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about something you can't get your fingers on, and it's galling you. That's what you're talking about. Oh, I've said too much here. You're the board. You do what you want with this thing.
I don't know what to do.
Just one thing more, though. This town needs this measly one-horse institution, if only to have a place where people can come without crawling to Potter. Come on, Uncle Billy.
Sentimental hogwash.
There you have it. A scene from It's a Wonderful Life, the radio play, on stage now at Playmakers through December 16th. Todd Lawson, you are playing actually two characters. Well, more than that, but you play Jake Lawrence, who plays George Bailey in this play. Let me ask you, first of all, what it's like to have to reprise this character who everybody knows is Jimmy Stewart. And there you are on stage taking this role.
And I'm a big fan of the film, and I knew it really well. There's the iconic Jimmy Stewart that you just, you know. All I've tried to do is try to pay homage to him and at the same time create the George Bailey that comes from my heart that can only come, you know, I can't be Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah.
I think it's
an amazing job of channeling all of the emotion and the sentiment that is in that scene without having to sound like Jimmy Stewart. It's a lot of work. Let me talk about the music, too, Mark Lewis. In terms of developing music for this, which is not in the original film, how do you go about doing that?
I find out I'm going to do the show a couple of months before rehearsals, and I compose a whole bunch of music that I know is not going to be used, because once you get into the rehearsal hall, the director creates the production. I think it's a lot. In reality, what you hear in the show came out of improvisation in the rehearsal hall, and my composing is kind of my way into the world. But really, I try to get in touch with the director's vision as much as possible and listen to what he tells me or she tells me, and contribute to that. You know, a lot of improvisation and then shaping it up as we go.
Nelson Eusebio, this is, as we said, not just the story, It's a Wonderful Life. It's a play within a play. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that. What role, then, do these characters play who are playing the roles of? What's the role of that part of the story?
So in Landry's adaptation, you meet these five different actors, and he gives you the credits and from the credits and what their names, you kind of get an idea of who they are. But the way our story kind of goes along is it starts out within that frame, and then as the play goes on, as the story goes on, as the radio play goes on, the radio play starts to sort of melt a little. That frame, that play within that frame starts to melt away. And so it becomes – it's still the actress Lana Sherwood, who plays Violet Bick and all these different people – but she transforms into all these. She transforms into all these people, not just vocally, but then physically. She may take different pieces of Lana's original costume that we saw her in and move them around, or alter them, or wear them in a different way to become these different characters.
Forgive me for interrupting you. This is not the sort of thing then where it starts out as an iconic movie, but it becomes the story of the actors who are trying to make thing.
It goes
the other way around.
It's the opposite way.
And ultimately becomes. And again, for you, the director, what are the challenges of bringing to life a film that we all know and there's only one version in our minds?
Right. Well, I think that's what's kind of great about the film is that there's the film itself and then there's the way we remember the film. Like, we remember iconic scenes, but not necessarily the whole story. and what we're trying to do on stage is create things that would resonate with your memory of the piece rather than, like, and in ways, and our way of doing that is to take a gesture that is in the film. I always use this example where, like, you know, Jimmy Stewart is trying to get in to Donna Reed's house, and he is trying to look all cool, and he hits the gate, and the gate, he can't even open the gate. And so Todd created this sort of theatrical equivalent of that on stage when he's trying to get into Mary's house, and so he just kind of jumps up from the floor all the way up to the stage. So it's finding sort of like little theatrical equivalents of that. And then I think in terms of the, excuse me, in terms of the other challenges, I think the biggest challenge is that you have to sort of let go of all those things and let go of the, it is the movie, and it's, we do, many people in who worked on the show are super fans of the movie, and there are people who have just seen the movie for the first time. So you have to kind of work within that by doing justice to those, to the people who really, really love the film, and still freeing the artists to create what they, to give them ownership of, over the material. Because if you don't own it, then, you know, we might as well just watch the movie. And so I think the other big creative challenge, especially for me as the director, is staging plays in which, staging a play in which, you know, one character throws himself out of the bar. And, you know, which actually happens twice in this show.
Well, we'll find out more about how that worked as we do a few more scenes from It's a Wonderful Life, the radio play at Playmakers in Chapel Hill on stage now through the 16th. We're going to continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about Playmakers Repertory Company production of It's a Wonderful Life live radio play. It's playing at the Center for Dramatic Art on the campus of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill now through December 16th. With us in the studio, Ray Dooley, Brandon Garignani, Katya Hill, Todd Lawson, Maren Searle, Mark Lewis, who's the music director, and Nelson Eusebio is the director. And I tell you what, before we do anything else, could we have another scene from the play?
Yeah,
could,
absolutely. That'd be great.
Set this one up for us.
So,
where are we?
George Bailey, the story of George Bailey is that he's always trying to leave Bedford Falls. And just the scene we just heard before, he was about to leave Bedford Falls and then his father dies that night. So he waits 4 more years and waiting for his brother to come home from college. His brother comes home from college to take over the family business so George can finally go. And his brother comes home with a brand new wife and a brand new job, not in Bedford Falls. So that night they have a big wedding party to celebrate his brother's wedding, and George finds himself outside on the porch having a moment of brooding, and then his mother comes out.
George?
Yeah, I'm out here on the porch, Mother. I just thought I'd get some air.
Well, how do you like the new sister-in-law?
She's swell.
She's sure to keep Harry on his toes.
Yeah. Keep him out of Bedford Falls, anyway.
George, do you know that Mary Hatch is back from school?
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice girl, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
The kind that'll help you find the answers, George.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, stop grumbling. Give me one good reason why you shouldn't call on Mary.
Well, Sam Wainwright. Sam's crazy about her.
Well, she's not crazy about him.
Well, now, how do you know that? Did she discuss it with you?
Besides, Sam is away in New York, and you're right here in Bedford Falls.
And all's fair in love and war?
I don't know about war.
All right, Mother. I think I'll go out and find the girl and do a little passionate necking.
Oh, George!
Goodbye, Mrs. Bailey. Oh, by the way, do you want any books from the library?
The library?
Uh-huh.
George, you go see Mary, you hear?
Good night, Mother.
There we have another scene from It's a Wonderful Life live radio. Todd Lawson there playing George Bailey and Maren Searle playing George's mother, Rose. And so let me ask you, the actors, and I'll start with you, Katya. You're playing multiple roles in this as a radio play, and yet you're on a stage in front of people. So how much of your sort of acting experience, the idea that you have to not just use your voice, but your body is part of this, there's a live audience, is that a conflict at all, that this is kind of a radio play and yet you're playing to a live audience?
Right. Well, the playwright pretty much gives us the frame by saying these are actors acting. We are all introduced as the cream of the crop actors you could ever be. And if you have an opportunity to portray an actor on stage, why not choose to be Meryl Streep, right? So we're told that Lana Sherwood is an amazing, you know, versatile actress who's played roles ranging from Mother Cabrini to Salome. So she could do just about anything. And of course, the costume designer sets up a very specific visual language of one unit costume per person. So the audience is invited into a language of transformation. I play, I think at last count, 18 characters, if you count the hubbubs. So you've got to start with broadside of the barn characterizations and then let the director edit the material that you give him into something more subtle.
And do you have to think about the character, the actor who's portraying the actor, as well as the role itself? I mean, does that all have to sort of roll through you as you say?
Oh, I think you could get meta on meta. And to quote Meryl Streep, who I think is the best of the best, you simply have to have a tremendous power of belief that you are whatever you are. So even if I'm playing Binky, the bouncer, you know, who's like, yeah, you got it, boss, with a big limp and extremely fat thighs, you just have to commit to that on stage and believe that the audience will come with you.
Nelson, what about the challenge of, and I think the excitement of actually seeing sound effects produced live on the stage? I mean, it's part of the theater, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's something really cool about, you know, because in the show we do certain gestures and then you see that you hear the sound. So, you know, like when we throw people out, we mime throwing them out and then you hear the door slam as they're evacuated from the... There's something really wonderful about that because it causes the audience to complete the picture in their head. And there's something about theater that we very often are trying to get people to think theatrically, to engage their imagination instead of think cinematically, which is, cinema is very prose-like. It describes everything. You see all of it, whereas theater is very poetic. It asks the viewer or the listener to make a certain leap of imagination.
Really engages them. Can we do another scene right now?
Yes. And this scene needs no introduction because it follows directly after the one we just heard.
Hello, George.
Hello, Mary. I just happened to be passing by.
Your mother just phoned and said you're on your way to pay me a visit.
My mother just called you? How did she know?
Well,
I didn't tell anyone. I went for a walk and just happened to be passing by. What do you... Went for a walk, that's all. Hey. Oh, when'd you get back?
Tuesday. Would you like to come in?
Well, I guess, since I'm here. Say, where'd you get that dress?
Oh, do you like it?
It's all right. Oh, I thought you'd go back to New York with Sam and Francie and the rest of them.
Oh, I worked there a couple of vacations, but I don't know. I guess I was homesick.
Homesick for Bedford Falls?
Well, yes, and my family and, everything. Would you like to sit down?
All right. For a minute. Yeah. You know, I still can't understand it, though. I didn't tell anybody I was coming over here.
Would you rather leave?
No, I don't want to be rude.
It was nice about Harry and Ruth, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's all right.
Well, don't you like her?
Well, of course I like her. She's a peach.
Oh, just marriage in general you're not enthusiastic about, huh?
No, marriage is okay for Harry and Sam Wainwright and you.
Mary? Mary, who's out there with you?
It's George Bailey, Mother.
George Bailey? What does he want?
I don't know. What do you want, George?
Me? Not a thing. I just came in to get warm.
He's making violent love to me, Mother.
You tell him to go right back home. Don't you leave the house. Sam Wainwright promised a call from New York tonight, didn't he?
Your mother needn't... You know, I didn't come over here for to...
What did you come here for?
I don't know. You tell me. You're the one that's supposed to have all the answers. You tell me.
Oh, why don't you go home?
Well, that's where I'm going. I don't know why I came over here in the first place.
Good night.
Good night.
Mary? Telephone. It's Sam.
I'll get it.
Hee-haw.
Hee-haw. Hi. Hello, Sam. How are you?
Ah, great. Gee, it's good to hear your voice again.
Oh, well, that's awfully sweet of you, Sam. There's an old friend of yours here, George Bailey. Oh,
you mean old Mossback George?
Yep, old Mossback George.
Well, hee-haw, put him on.
Okay, I'll call him. George!
He doesn't want to talk to George, you idiot.
He does so. He asked for him. George, Sam wants to speak to you.
Hello, Sam.
Hey! Fine pal you are. What are you trying to do? Steal my girl?
What do you mean? Nobody's trying to steal your girl.
No, I'm just kidding.
What?
Tell Mary to get on the extension. I want to talk to both of you.
All right.
Mother's on the extension.
I am not!
Oh.
We can both hear you. George, just put your head a little closer.
Okay.
There. That's better. We're listening, Sam.
All right. Now I got a big deal coming up that's going to make us all rich. George, you remember that night at Martini's Bar? You told me about making plastics out of soybeans.
Huh?
Soybeans. My father's looked into it, George, see, and now he's going to build a factory outside of Rochester. How do you like that?
Rochester? Well, why Rochester?
Well, why not? I mean, can you think of anything better?
Well, I don't know. Why not right here in Bedford Falls? You remember that old tool and machinery works? You tell your father he can get that for a song, and all the labor he wants, too. Half the town was thrown out of work when they closed down.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell him. Hey, that sounds great. Oh, baby, I knew you'd come through, George. Now, here is the point. I may have a job for you. That is, unless you're still married to the old broken-down building and loan. Oh, Mary.
I'm here.
Hey, you tell that guy I am giving him the chance of a lifetime. You hear?
He says it's the chance of a lifetime.
You give me that phone. Now, you listen to me, Mary. I don't want any plastics. I don't want any job, and I don't want to get married ever to anyone. You understand that? I want to do what I want to do, and you're not gonna... Oh, Mary.
George.
Oh, Mary, I love you.
George, I love you too.
There we have Todd Lawson, Maren Searle, Katya Hill, and Brandon Garignani, who, along with Ray Dooley, are starring in It's a Wonderful Life, the live radio show, and it is on stage now at Playmakers in Chapel Hill through December 16th. You know, I was scared to death when I saw the scene was coming, because that is my favorite scene in all of cinema. That scene me cry every time I see it.
Yeah. That's a good one.
I now have tears in my eyes. That is amazing, because I was really scared that I was not going to like it. Then they were going to open the mic, and now what am I going to say? It's amazing that you can bring that to life. But Nelson, who is Eusebio, who's the director, Mark Lewis is with us as well, the music director. I think that points out something important about the movie and then this play. It's a love story, ultimately, mm-hmm. and it's about love in many forms. It's about the kind of love that can transform
right,
an individual.
Absolutely.
But then to have it grounded in this beautiful love story between two people must be a kind of a real joy for a director, isn't it?
It really provides a guideline for you, that George and Mary are this, like, there's really great romantic comedy writing in this scene. I think it's really well written. And it's really, this is also my favorite scene in the whole thing. and part of the challenge of it, I think, is the fact that in cinema like that, the little 2 inches between Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed are like so charged, and you can cut away to close-ups, and you can cut away to Sam Wainwright with like some woman like massaging his shoulder so you don't actually feel bad for Sam. There's just numerous like little advantages, but I think, they do such a great job. And it's great to hear this scene, at the mics, because when you see our production, it doesn't necessarily all happen at the mics, but I talked about how we leave the radio station behind to go to Bedford Falls, and the sort of key to that, I think, is the love story between George and Mary, and it really follows that, and that's kind of the audience's in, and was my in into the story as well.
Can we do another scene?
Yeah, absolutely. What scene are we going to do now? Zuzu and George is our last one. This really doesn't need much of an introduction, except that George Bailey has come home after Uncle Billy has lost $8,000 and his business career could be over and he might be going to jail. And he comes home to a house full of kids on Christmas Eve who are super excited and super loud. And, you know, there are four children on Christmas Eve. And little Zuzu is their youngest child. She's sick. And George, in a moment of respite, goes up to see her. And this is a cute little scene.
Hi, Daddy.
Now, what happened to you?
I want a flower.
Where do you think you're going?
Want to give my flower a drink.
Okay, here. Give Daddy the flower. I'll give it a drink.
Some of the petals came off. Paste it.
Oh. Okay, all right. I'll paste this back together here. Now. There. Good as new.
Give the flower a drink.
Now, will you do something for me?
What?
Will you try and get some sleep?
I'm not sleepy. I want to look at my flower.
I know. But if you go to sleep, you can dream about it. And it'll be a whole garden.
It will?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's Katya Hill and Todd Lawson doing a scene from It's a Wonderful Life live radio play on stage at Playmakers through December 16th. You know, let me ask you, Nelson, it's interesting the trajectory of this play or the mm-hmm. course that it's run, because when it first came out just after World War II, people didn't see it and the critics thought, well, the problem is it was a dark film right. and nobody wanted to see that after World War II. Now, if there are critics of the film at all, they say it's a little bit too sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it really isn't. It's got, no. I mean, this is a,
no.
How do you manage those two? Because there's a lot of sweetness in it. There's a lot of, you know, wonderful moments like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet George Bailey's going through a lot.
I think if you don't, you know, Joe and I, Joe Hodge and I, the artistic director, talked about this. It's, if you don't find the bottom of this story, then the redemption doesn't mean as much. And sort of my nature as a director, I like to find the really dark edge of things. So we push that a little bit. And that's something that Todd and I work together on a lot on this, is just constantly talking about how if you make it, the other people around you, the three other characters who play all these different people, they're going to provide the comedy. You have to provide the tragic end of it. And, you know, if you don't believe that George Bailey is going to kill himself, then you aren't redeemed at the end. You really have to push the edge of that. In order for the audience to feel that, then Todd really has to, you know, the actor playing George has to go there with it. And, you know, when we were auditioning actors in New York for this role, we read the boardroom sides, and the woman, Stephanie Clapper, our casting director, turned to us and was like, oh my God, this is such great writing, you know, talking about living in slums and housing, and even Potter's side of the argument is very political and astute for its time and still has a tremendous amount of resonance today. You know, Joe calls this the American Christmas Carol, and I think it is, in that, you know, George Bailey is your typical American dreamer. He wants to get ahead. He wants to have a better life. He wants to leave and do all these things. And at the same time, you know, he is an incredible person, a person of incredible character that, despite never getting what he wants in some way, he stays and he does the right thing by his wife and does the right thing by his children.
Well, he finds out what he wants because he finds love. And
right.
love is the thing that opens his heart to who he is. That's the beauty of this mm-hmm. play, is that it is probably more relevant today socially mm-hmm. and economically than it was when it was written.
Yes.
But there is this metaphysical quality about the play that says none of the arguments about economics are going to get you anywhere unless you find love and then
right.
find yourself. I mean, it is beautifully written, isn't it?
Yes.
So, Todd, let me ask you about how, because you saw the film, obviously. Had you seen it? I mean, is it a favorite of yours?
It's a favorite of mine, yeah.
So when you actually had to play this character, what did you learn about the character that you didn't see in the film in terms of coming to this dark side?
Well, the funny thing is, like when you were saying that now some of the critics say it's too sweet. And I wasn't a critic of that. I'm a pretty sentimental guy, and I thought it was a sweet, sweet story. But really getting really deep into it and going and seeing those dark places that Nelson just talked about, I mean, he really does. He makes every decision that is not what he wants to do, but is the right thing to do, every step of the way. for everyone else but him. He is pretty selfless in this piece, even down to the decision of, I mean, coming to grips with the fact that he is worth more dead than alive, and the only way to get his family out of what he thinks is the bottom is to take his own life. So that part for me, I was like, wow, this is a lot harder to play than I thought it was going to be.
Well, you're doing a beautiful job. It's a wonderful story. It's a wonderful life. And it's a wonderful play on stage now at Playmakers. Thank all of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Playmakers Repertory Company production of It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play at the Center for Dramatic Art on the campus of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, now through December 16th. Ray Dooley is Freddie Fillmore. Brandon Garignani plays Harry. Jasbo Haywood and a number of other characters. Katya Hill is there. Todd Lawson. Maren Searle is in the play as well. Mark Lewis is the music director, and Nelson Eusebio, the director. For more information, you go to playmakersrep.org. Coming up on The State of Things, who was St. Nicholas? Find out in a moment. Stay tuned. Whisper what you bring to me.